It's February 2nd, 2011, and Representative Krieger has some remarks.
Just co-chair. Historically, members, this committee has had a nice party at the end of the year, and we fund that party in a unique manner. The staff keeps track of the total number of minutes that members of this committee are late. The person who has the most minutes pays for the party. So be prepared.
I like it.
Today's an informational meeting, and I'd like to have Honorable David Brewer, Chief Judge of the Oregon Court of Appeals, and Honorable Jack Landau, Justice, Oregon Supreme Court, come forward and give us some information on how courts interpret statutes. And thank you very much for taking your valuable time to come over here to help us out.
Co-chairs Barker and Krieger and members of the committee, I'm Dave Brewer, the Chief Judge of the Oregon Court of Appeals, and I can assure you on behalf of myself and Justice Landau that it's our privilege to be here, and we send you greetings from the Chief Justice and the Oregon Judicial Department. We also thank you for this opportunity to discuss the process of statutory interpretation in Oregon, and second, constitutional law issues and how they're analyzed in Oregon courts. And before we dig in, first of all, Justice Landau is going to take the lead on this, but before we dig in, I'd like to make a couple of comments about our approach to this discussion. First, what we want to advance today, in keeping with the tradition that we've tried to develop with you, is an ongoing dialogue that's helpful, hopefully, in explaining how Oregon's courts construe your statutory enactments and the Oregon Constitution. Our goal, as always, is to go beyond a relationship where we communicate with you only in the form of written opinions after you've enacted a statute, when it's too late for us to have a clear understanding of what the legislature meant in choosing the words of the statute. The bottom line is what we want to do is to be available as a resource when you seek our help in crafting good statutes while always respecting the legislature's domain in setting policy. We can talk about some examples of how that has worked and how it might work best as our discussion unfolds today. And we're also here to answer your questions and hear your concerns on these subjects and any others that you might want to talk to us about conveniently. So feel free, please, to interrupt us whenever you please. Don't feel like you need to hold a question. Let's make this a conversation if that's okay with you. The second thing I'd like to do is to briefly place today's discussion about statutory interpretation in a broader context. Because in the last half of the 20th century, there were some major changes in how law was developing in this country. Before then, most of the law that we applied in our nation's state courts came from the common law. And much of that law had its origins in ancient precedents that predated even the founding of the American government. But after World War II, state legislatures, including the Oregon legislature, became much more active in developing the law through the enactment of legislation. As a result, the court's roles have changed very much as well. And to illustrate that point, the Oregon Court of Appeals, on which I work, handles nearly all of the initial appeals from trial court and state agency decisions in Oregon. A conservative estimate today is that about three-quarters of those appeals primarily involve disagreements about the meaning of statutes and sometimes administrative rules. And so, for us, that enterprise of construing those statutes focuses first and foremost on what the legislature that enacted the statute intended for the words that it chose to mean. And to make sure we get that intent right, it's critical to have practical, predictable, and reliable sources of statutory interpretation. And those rules have developed over time from two sources. Some principles have come from appellate decisions as we encounter new twists and variations on problems that are presented in particular lawsuits. But more important are the principles that the Legislative Assembly itself has codified in statutes that instruct the courts in some circumstances how we should determine a statute's meaning. And so we have a handout for you that's been handed out by your staff that sets out the statutes that describe the most commonly used legislative principles of interpretation. We hope that as you move through a very busy and condensed session, these principles will be of use to you as you consider the words you choose in your enactments. In addition, I've taken the liberty of providing each of you with a copy of the recently published annual report of the Oregon Court of Appeals. And as many of you know, it's our practice each year to report to the Chief Justice and the Legislative Assembly on our work. We won't take the time to discuss the report today, but I hope it provides you with some useful information about the way we do our work and gives you a sense of our workload. This year's report describes our continuing effort to re-examine the way we do our work in order to be more efficient and productive in these challenging budget times. And I'm happy to discuss the issues in that report with any of you at any time. All you have to do is call on me. So now, it's my pleasure to introduce you to my colleague, Justice Jack Landau, one of my dear friends, who just this last month was sworn in as a Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court. For the previous 18 years, Justice Landau served as a judge on the Oregon Court of Appeals until he was elected by the voters last year to replace Justice Nick Gillette on his retirement from the Supreme Court. For many years, Jack was a presiding judge of one of our regular panels on the Court of Appeals. He's a graduate of Franklin High School in Portland, Lewis and Clark College, Northwestern School of Law at Lewis and Clark, and he has an advanced law degree from the University of Virginia. Before coming to the Court of Appeals, he had extensive experience in private practice and had the distinction of serving as Deputy Attorney General for Oregon. He's one of the leading scholars and teachers, in my opinion, in Oregon on the subjects of statutory construction and Oregon constitutional law. And he'll take the lead, with your indulgence, in our presentation today. Jack and I are going to have a conversation, but at this time I'm going to turn it over to him. Jack.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dave, thanks for that introduction. I think of all the introductions I've ever received, that's the most recent.
I didn't promise you'd have a good
citizen. Justice, you need to identify yourself for the record.
Yes, I was just going to say, for the record, my name is Jack Landau. I'm Associate Justice on the Oregon Supreme Court. It is really a pleasure to be here. It's a privilege. Often scholars talk about, as Judge Brewer mentioned, a conversation between the legislature and the courts. But they usually refer to the conversation that takes place between the statutes that you enact and then the cases by which we interpret the statutes and then perhaps amendments to the statutes in response. We have something that's different, and as far as I understand, it's unique because we're actually having a real conversation about the work that we do. I was on the phone with a friend of mine who teaches at Columbia University, and I mentioned that we were doing this, and she said, "Really? You're talking to the legislators?" Things are different here in Oregon in a really wonderful way. This is an opportunity for us to talk about the work that you do, the work that we do, and how that work intersects, because it's not often appreciated the way that the work that you do affects what we do and the way the work we do affects what you do. And our hope is that by having this conversation today, you have a better appreciation for the rules that govern the work that both of us do. So that, for example, when we talk about the interpretation of statutes, we understand what the rules are that constrain us in giving effect to the statutes that you enact, so that you know when you're enacting the statutes in the first place, what's going to happen when they get into court, and the rules that are going to govern us in applying them. As I understand it, you've asked us to talk about two subjects today. The first is constitutional principles in lawmaking, and the second is specific rules of statutory construction. We'll start with first things first, and constitutional principles in lawmaking. The work that you do and that we do is, in the first instance, governed by the state constitution. The Constitution is that charter, that basic document that by which the people take the political power that they possess and they create a government and they allocate that political power among the three branches of government and then set limits on the exercise of that power by each of the three branches. Let's just go back and talk about each of those three steps for just a second. The first thing that the Constitution does is it creates a government. It creates a government in three branches. Interestingly, in our Constitution, they're called departments. And that's why, for example, the Judicial Department is called the Judicial Department, not because it's another department, you know, the one in the phone book right after the Hazelnut Department. It's a department because that's what the framers thought of in terms of the three basic departments of government power. The second thing that the framers did was they took the political power that all people have and they split it up into three forms of power so that the legislative power was conferred on the legislature, and some of it reserved back by the people to initiate legislation on their own without the legislature itself through the initiative and the referendum. The legislative power goes to you folks. The judicial power under the Constitution is conferred upon the Supreme Court. Actually, if you look in the original Supreme Court, it's spelled Supreme Court in the original Constitution. Spelling was not something they paid quite so much attention to back then. And other inferior courts, as you, the legislature, create, the executive power is conferred on the governor and the executive branch. The third thing that we're going to talk about is that it sets limits on the exercise of that power. The Constitution, in addition to allocating that power, says each of the branches cannot do certain things. For example, Article 3 of the Constitution sets out the separation of powers principles and says no member of one branch of government can exercise the powers of another branch. No one branch of government can interfere with the other branch's exercise of its powers. So it allocates power, and then it sets limits on the exercise of that power. With that in mind, let's think a minute about legislation and making statutes and the particular powers the Constitution talks about in that regard.
Jack, so how do we know what legislative power means?
Well, that's actually really interesting because the Constitution very generally confers on the legislature the legislative power, but it doesn't say what the legislative power is. And that's a really important point for us to understand because not all constitutions are drafted that way. The federal constitution, for example, is a constitution of limited enumerated powers so that Congress, in order for it to enact a statute, has to find a specific grant of authority in the federal constitution to enact that kind of law. If you look at today's paper, for example, there are articles about whether the recently enacted health care package is constitutional. Well, the issue is about whether Congress can find authority in the Constitution for its enactment of that statute.
So, Jack, is it fair to say that we see a lot more, by volume, litigation at the federal level about identifying the source of congressional power to do something because of that limitation to enumerated power?
Absolutely. If the courts can't find a hook in the Constitution on which you can hang the authority of Congress, the statute's unconstitutional. In the Oregon Constitution, that's not the way it works. The Oregon Constitution confers all legislative power on you, the legislature. That means, courts have a word for it. They say that the legislature has plenary power. You have the authority to legislate on virtually any subject whatever in your judgment for the public's benefit, unless there are some specific limits on that authority. There are two sources of limits on that otherwise blanket authority that we all need to be aware of. The first one is the federal constitution and federal laws, because under our federal constitution, federal law is the supreme law of the land. And so notwithstanding the plenary power of the state legislature, if the federal constitution or if Congress says you can't enact a statute in this particular area, well, then you can't enact a statute in that particular area. Federal law is supreme. The other limitation on the exercise of your plenary authority is in the Oregon Constitution itself. The Oregon Constitution actually spells out limitations on the exercise of its authority in two ways. The first way is it spells out certain constitutional procedures that have to be followed in order for legislation to be valid. If you look at Article 4 in the Constitution, it actually spells out a lot of that stuff. Revenue bills have to originate in the House of Representatives. That's a constitutional procedural requirement. Deliberations have to be open. Bills have to be read by their title a certain number of times before they can be enacted into law. Each act has to have only one subject, and the subject has to be expressed in its title. Those are procedural limitations on the legislative power that the Constitution itself spells out. Then there are also substantive limitations. The Constitution actually tells you there are certain kinds of law, notwithstanding your plenary power, certain kinds of laws you can't enact. Usually the Constitution handily gives you a clue about what those are. The Constitution will begin those limitations with the words, "No law shall be passed." And I counted up, there are some 9 or 10 specific provisions in the state constitution that says no law shall be passed. Those are the kinds of laws that you just can't enact if they're going to be valid. For example, Article 1, Section 29 says no law shall be passed granting a title of nobility. Silly example, but it's there in the Constitution because back in the 19th century, people cared about such things. What that means is, if the legislature passes a law that grants a title of nobility, it violates the Constitution. It's unconstitutional. It's invalid. There are certain things the legislature can't do. Similar limitations can be found in the Bill of Rights, in Article 1, Section 3, for example, says no law shall in any case whatever control the free exercise and enjoyment of religion. Section 8 says no law shall be passed restraining the free expression of opinion or the right to speak, write, or print freely on any subject.
Jack, well, I know we'll talk about Article 1, Section 10 maybe a little bit later, but that's the provision that requires that court proceedings be open and that justice be administered without delay. That's a requirement that applies to all the branches of government, doesn't it? It's both a restraint on the courts, and it's also applies to the legislature.
That's a great point. Some of the limitations on legislative authority are real explicit, and the Constitution says no law shall be passed. Some of them are quite so obvious. The open Article 1, Section 10, for example, doesn't say anything about no law shall be passed, but the Oregon courts have looked at the Constitution and interpreted it so that it applies to any branch of government. That's actually a good segue to where the courts come into the picture. Sometimes these limitations on the exercise of legislative power aren't so clear. For example, when Article 1, Section 8 says that no law shall be passed restraining the right to speak or print freely in any subject, whatever, what does that mean? Does it protect flag burning? Is that the right to speak or print freely? That's where the courts come into play. The court's job is to interpret the Constitution so that it can be applied to disputes between parties about the meaning of the Constitution. Remember, courts under Article 7 of the state Constitution have the judicial power. Ever since Marbury versus Madison, state and federal courts have understood that the judicial power means the power to interpret the meaning of the constitutions. And so when there's a limitation on the exercise of legislative authority and it's not real clear what that is, that's what the courts have to do.
I wanted to say maybe this is a good point to stop and make two points about the differences between constitutions and statutes. And forgive me if this is obvious, but because constitutions are these organic overarching documents that apply broadly, you'll often see those provisions be written in ways that are so broad that there's a significant room for interpretation. And so the court's roles when it comes to constitutional interpretation, the kinds of provisions that Justice Landau and I have been citing, are a little more difficult to gauge, simply because the wording can be so broad. When you do your job well, which is almost always in our views, you write specific, precise statutes that give us good direction. But the Constitution is deliberately written more broadly than that, and it doesn't deal with the kinds of particulars, and so the court's role can actually be more difficult in that. And so what I was thinking is we might want to talk, even though it isn't the same as statutory interpretation principles, about the methodology that we use to interpret the Constitution and the differences between original provisions that date back to the 1850s and amendments and legislative referrals, because that might be of some use to folks here as well.
A real good point. When we are confronted with interpreting the Constitution, sometimes it's real easy. You know, the governor has to be certain number of years old, and you can figure that out, right? Sometimes it's a little broader. The Constitution, for example, says that no law can interfere with the citizen's right to be free from an unreasonable search and seizure. What does that mean? How do you know what an unreasonable search and seizure is? The Constitution says that we all have a right to bear arms. Well, what does that mean? Arms back in 1857, when the Constitution was adopted, referred to one thing. Arms right now can mean something entirely different. So what the courts have to do is figure out a way of giving meaning to the Constitution today. Essentially, the way that the Oregon courts do it is they try to give the meaning to the constitutional provision that the framers of the Constitution would have intended it to have. So we will look at the text of the Constitution in its historical context, try to figure out what was the problem that the framers were trying to get at in adopting this particular provision of the Constitution, and in that context, looking at the language, looking at the history, then how does that general policy apply to modern circumstances? So just to take an example, the right to bear arms. We had a case about 10, 15 years ago about the constitutionality of a restriction on possession of assault rifles. Under the Constitution, you have a right to bear arms. What does that mean? The Supreme Court looks at that and says, well, is the modern kind of arm, the sort of weapon that the framers would have understood they had a right to possess? Is it the kind of weapon that one would need? You go back and you look at the purpose of having a right to bear arms. Was it the kind of weapon that you need to protect your family, to defend the state against possible attack or harm? And looking at those considerations, you can apply that general principle to modern circumstances.
And one of the real challenges there is, in light of technological advances and other things that have occurred in society since 1859, we have sometimes a challenge of figuring out whether a specific constitutional provision even applies to the new circumstance. So is it an arm,
right,
or is it something else? And that can create some real analytical challenges. But because we all start with the premise that this is an organic document, that the framers of our Constitution intended to be an enduring blueprint for how we govern our relationships, we look to that document and we treat it with that kind of respect. But it does present perhaps some greater challenges and some more play in the joints because of the looseness of the language in many circumstances and this updating problem that we don't see as often in statutes. And that's why there's so much attention given to appellate decisions construing constitutional provisions. And you'll see people say, well, how did they get that out of the language? And it becomes much more of a challenge.
The most important thing, it seems to me, for us to say here is that in no event, when we're called upon to examine the constitutionality of legislation, nowhere is it the job of the courts to second-guess the policy judgments of the Oregon legislature. You've no doubt heard, or if you haven't, you certainly will hear the Chief Justice DeMunis say, it is not the job of the courts to pass on the wisdom of legislation. The legislative power rests with the people and the legislative assembly, and we're very fine with that allocation of power. We did not become judges so that we can act as legislators in black robes.
Thank you. Representative Wand has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your Honors, thank you for being here. The question I have is, when the legislature passes a law that's signed by the governor that eventually ends up on your desk, do you expect that the individual legislators in their own minds have made some sort of an initial determination as to whether that law is constitutional? Or is that something that an issue that never crosses your mind at all as you're reviewing that statute?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wand, if I understand the question correctly, it's do we assume that the legislators have thought about the constitutionality of the laws that they have? I think the answer is generally yes. And it comes into play when we talk about the statutory construction issues in a very concrete way. If you have a statute, for example, that is really ambiguous, I mean, you just can't figure out what it means. You look at the text, it could mean any of a number of things. You look at the legislative history, you still can't find any evidence of what the legislature intended. But if one interpretation would be constitutional and the other interpretation might be of doubtful constitutionality, the courts will always assume that the legislature intended its enactments to be interpreted in a way that would be constitutional.
If I might just add to that, co-chairs and Representative Wand, our courts struggle with that issue in a number of cases where the text may not be as clear as we would like and the legislative history is sparse. We have, just in the Court of Appeals, a case that will probably be issued in a couple of weeks where that third level principle that we'll talk about in a minute gets applied in order to save the statute, because there are two ways in our view to look at the statute. One is constitutional. Our goal is to save a statute that can be constitutionally applied always. Always.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Judges, sometimes, as you stated, we don't use the proper words to really talk about what legislative intent was. And even I've had bills where I tried to do that, I wasn't comfortable that maybe someday someone might not follow what I said. So I have on occasion said, men in black robes, this is what the law says. This is what we intended to say, even if we didn't use the right words to say it. This is what we meant. Does that help? I mean, how would you get around that is what I'm kind of looking at.
Mr. Chair, that is a great kind of jumping off point for shifting from talking about the constitutional issues in lawmaking to the principles of statutory construction. In Oregon, the rules, as Judge Brewer said, statutory construction derived from two sources, from you, the legislator, and that's those rules are contained in the handout that we gave you. The rules are in Chapter 174. Some of the rules are judge-created over the centuries. In a nutshell, in Oregon, what we've done is we've looked at all those rules and we have said we interpret statutes the following way. Our job, it's actually in the statute in ORS 174.020, our job is to ascertain what you, the legislature, intended the statute to mean. That's our goal. Our goal is to look at the words of the statute and figure out what you intended them to mean. How do we figure out what you intended the statute to mean? It's essentially a two-step process. We look at the words of the statute. You think about it, lawmaking is about words. It's about a very formal process. In order to become law under our Constitution, the legislature has to put words on a piece of paper, and those words have to be approved first by the committee, then by one house, and then that piece of paper gets shuttled over to the other house, and it has to be approved and then signed into law by the governor. What we have to do is we have to interpret what those words mean. If there's anything that you remember from what I say today, it would be this. We can implement your intentions only if you put them into the words of the statute. If they're not in the statute, we can't create them for you. What we have to do is work with the language that you give us. In order for us to effectuate your intentions, there have to be words that, when reasonably construed, can be given the effect that you want.
Can I just interject? And, Mr. Chair, Co-Chair, I guess I want to just reinforce what Jack said in regard to the statutes, because in Chapter 174, there is a specific legislative directive for the courts to declare in terms and substance what the statute says, neither to insert words nor omit them. This is a specific directive that you've given us. The challenges sometimes arise in the use of words that, depending on context, could mean more than one thing. And so we don't just look at the words blindly without looking beyond, and I think that's where Jack wants to head next.
And that's exactly where I'm headed, to get more directly to your point, Mr. Chair. We have to, though, start with the words, and that's really, really the important point that we need to work with, not just because we're pinheaded and you know, we sit there in our robes and say, you didn't use the right words. It's because that's one of the rules that you gave us to work with. You have told us, as Dave just said, we can't add words, we can't take them away. That's because we're not the policymakers. You are the policymakers.
Could I ask a question?
Yes, please.
Thank you. Following up on the co-chair's question, and I guess I would have some question about if you wrote what your intent was in the legislation, you personally wrote it to the court, I might have some question about that. But I'm wondering if in committee, when we pass a bill and we say, this is what we mean by this line, does that carry any weight? Does that help clarify?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Tomei, let me just give you the short answer. Yes. It helps. When we look at statutes, the first thing we do is look to see if you have defined the statutes, because you can define statutes to mean anything you want. If you want, to pick a real example, if you want the term motor vehicle in the Motor Vehicle Code to include motorized skateboards, you can do that. And if you do it, we'll give it effect. If you don't want it to include motorized skateboards, then don't, and we'll look at the definitions that you include. If there isn't a definition, what we'll do is we'll assume that you will use words in the way that ordinary people use words, and we'll look it up in a dictionary. We'll usually use Webster's Third New International Dictionary because it reports common usage. It's not a group of grammarians who are saying this is what the word means and can't mean anything else. It's supposed to record common speech, and that's why we do that.
Jack, if I could, I think, I know where you're headed here, I think Representative Tomei's question is a great one, and it's moving to this area of legislative history and how, particularly when we've got ambiguous statutes, we look at that hierarchy of your expressed intent, and we actually have probably 15 or 20 minutes to talk to you about in that regard. The reason Jack is starting before we get to legislative history is there's kind of been this hierarchy of analysis that we use, starting with text and then context, which we haven't talked a lot about, and then looking at legislative history. Now, by statute, in the last several years, you have allowed the courts to look at legislative history even when a statute isn't ambiguous. And so you're going to see a lot more case law now where we're going back and forth all the time, sort of like an investigator in a criminal case looking for clues and amassing them as to legislative intent. But judges, because of the way that this analysis always proceeded historically, are used to starting out with the words because they're the direct and best evidence of legislative intent, and then looking at the words in context and then seeing if that doesn't answer the question, then we go to legislative history. And so where I think you want to go next is just talk a little more about context and then hit those rules, if that's okay, on the legislative intent.
Yes, yes, thank you. So talking, using the example of the motorized vehicle, so if in a work session when we were crafting and going to be voting on this legislation, if we said our intent is to, even though it might not say it in the legislation itself, our intent is to include motorized skateboards in this, is that correct, Mr. Speaker? And the Speaker says yes, or Chair. So it's in our minutes, but it's not in that legislation.
Chair, Representative May. Yes, the first and best way to make sure that the courts get it right is to put it into the words of the statute. Okay. If you don't do that, though, as long as saying that a motorized skateboard is a motor vehicle is a reasonable construction of the words, then putting it in the legislative history is very, very helpful. And we will always try to respect that history as long as whatever it shows your intentions are capable of being carried out by the words of the statute. So, for example, if a statute says black, and what you really mean is white, and you put white in the legislative history, you know, there's not much we're going to be able to do to help you.
That's a problem.
Okay, but as long as it's a reasonable construction of the words, the legislative history is very, very helpful, and we'll always respect it if we possibly can.
And this sort of gets back, Jack, doesn't it, to this first principle that we can't change the plain meaning of words. You've instructed us not to do that. And so this is why Jack is emphasizing that if you intend to depart from the ordinary meaning of words, it's really good to have a definition section in your statute where you say that. And then that way, we're not violating the prohibition of reading something in that isn't there, because you've specifically overridden that in this particular case. So definition sections are the enemies of ambiguity, and they're the friends of the legislature, where you can anticipate different examples, some of which might even be counterintuitive, where you actually intend for a statute to apply. It's really good to define it that way and just end the discussion right up front.
Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, Your Honors. While we're on this subject, how would you handle it if in conversation in this committee, let's use your example, the statute says black, and we say here, we intend for that, well, say the statute says dark colored, and in this committee, someone puts on the record that we intend for that to mean black and black only, and, well, actually, this side of the building, the Senate Judiciary Committee gets that same bill, and they, someone puts on their record, well, I'm willing to support this bill, and my yes vote on this bill is because I know that dark includes charcoal gray. So now you have competing legislative intent. How do you handle that dilemma?
It's kind of like dark white.
Co-Chair, Representative Nolan, very gingerly.
that actually does happen, as you can imagine. We occasionally, not often, and I should say this, by the way, I've taught legislation at Willamette for nearly 20 years and have watched statutes and statutory construction for a long time. And I can honestly say the work product of the Oregon legislature is head and shoulders above pretty much anybody else around. I mean, it is what this institution does in conjunction with the work of legislative council is really first rate. And we don't nearly have as many of these really difficult statutory construction problems as I have seen in a lot of other states. We do get them, though. What we try to do as best we can is reconstruct what most likely the institution had in mind. In doing that, we will weigh different types of legislative history. Some of the legislative history is going to end up mattering more than other kinds of legislative history, and that's how we'll try to resolve that. For example, some of the legislative history may consist of statements of lobbyists in a hearing. As a general rule, there are exceptions to this, but as a general rule, we don't put a lot of weight into statements of lobbyists. I remember an incident in which a legislator in committee interrupted a lobbyist with a question during the presentation in the public hearing, and the lobbyist asked the legislator to hold off on the questions because he was trying to make some legislative history. And the chair interrupted and said, "Excuse me, but that's our job to create legislative history, not yours." And the chair was absolutely right. In some cases, the legislature has to rely on information provided by non-legislators, especially when the subject of the legislation is very complex. It's arcane, environmental regulation, for example, where you may have to rely on information provided to you by representatives of state agencies. And we may be more likely to take that information into account and give it more weight, particularly when you, members of the committee, put it on the record that the information provided by the lobbyist or the representative of an interest group is important to you. And that can really help us understand the significance of that piece of information.
Before we kind of get into the hierarchy, because I think that's really the meat of what we wanted to talk to you about is the hierarchy, I think Representative Nolan's question really presents an interesting issue that goes through all three steps of the analysis. If we assume that you have, and this, I can't remember this happening, but it could, if you assume we have legislators in both houses saying the opposite thing about what dark color means in that situation, what we might say is this. Let's sort of give a peek as to how Jack and I, if we're looking at this problem before oral argument or as we're drafting opinion, might talk about this. I might say to Jack, and then I'll get his response, well, you know, dark color is a term that could have more than one legitimate meaning or plausible meaning. And so because of that, my sense is that may be an ambiguous term. It doesn't have an obvious plain meaning, and it's one of those perfect situations to look at legislative history to see whether there are some clues. Okay, so then I say, now Jack, so I did that. I went and I looked at the legislative history, and I've got a very unique situation. I've got legislators from both houses saying exactly the opposite thing, and I don't have anything else that breaks the tie. And so in that situation, I'm going to probably end up concluding, and you may disagree with me, so let's talk about it, that you've got legislative history of equal rank that goes in opposite directions, so that doesn't help me either. I've still got an ambiguous statute. So now I'm going to go to the third level of statutory construction, and I'm going to apply canons of construction because the court can't just not give a meaning to the statute. The court has to give an answer. And so that's what these third level canons of construction are. For example, we're not supposed to interpret a statute in a way that would be unconstitutional if, in fact, we can reasonably interpret it to be constitutional. We can't come up with something that would promote such an absurd result. That's another canon of construction that we could honestly look at ourselves and say no sane person would have intended that. So we've got this prohibition on absurd results. So what I would probably be doing, Mr. Chair and Representative Nolan, in that scenario, is thinking just that way, and then saying to Jack, I'm thinking maybe we got to go to the third level on this one, and which canons do you think apply? Why don't you give your feedback, because I think that's useful.
That's Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, that's pretty much the roadmap that we would use. We first look at the text of the statute in context, and the fact of the matter is, in most cases, that's pretty much the end of it. It's pretty clear. We'll look at legislative history, and sometimes the legislative history can be helpful. Sometimes the legislative history can conflict. But remember this, too. Just because a statute is ambiguous doesn't mean that the competing interpretations are in equipoise and they're equally plausible. You could have one that's, because of any number of considerations, by far and away the more likely, and the other one maybe not as likely, but you know, it's still arguable. We're all lawyers here. We on the courts. And, you know, we can talk ourselves into all kinds of interesting things. So,
how about on this one? Which is the more plausible? Just give a peek behind the curtain. If you got a statute that says dark color, and you're weighing, you've got some no real strong help in the legislative history, but you may have unequally plausible inferences. Which way you're going to leap on that?
Right. So, I mean, if you have one that's way more plausible than the other, it's going to take some pretty hefty legislative history to get me to move it to a different direction. That's where I was going. If you really can't figure it out, there are these rules that the judges have come up with, the tiebreakers that Dave has mentioned. So if one would likely lead to an absurd policy result and the other wouldn't, we'll always give the legislature the benefit of the doubt and try to go with the one that's not absurd. If one's likely unconstitutional, even arguably unconstitutional, and the other one's not, we're always going to give the legislature the benefit of the doubt, and that's how we're going to resolve it.
This absurd results, Max, and some of these other maxims that we apply, or canons we call them, that's a legal term for these rules that we apply where we don't have a clear expression of intent. We got to be careful, like we're handling dynamite with that, because how in the world, who are we to say sometimes that this is an absurd result? Because it may be exactly what somebody else meant to do. And so absurdity in our world can be in the eye of the beholder. And again, there's a restraint on the judicial power in not declaring something absurd too lightly, because there may be other reasons why somebody thought it was the right thing to do. And again, our exercise of restraint makes us much less comfortable at this third level, because then we feel like there's a risk, if we're not careful, that we're going off into policy thickets that we shouldn't be in. Does that make sense?
One of the things that we take into account is the clarity of the particular statement in the legislative record. And this gets to what Representative Krieger was talking about. There's legislative history and then there's legislative history, right? I mean, sometimes it can be very clear. My favorite example is a former Representative Mannix was here and he introduced a bill that was designed to correct what he thought were erroneous rulings of the Workers' Compensation Board and the Court of Appeals in interpreting what a new injury is in the workers' compensation statutes. And what he said in committee was, let's state for the record what it says here. First, this will do away with current court interpretations of what's a new injury. Do you hear that, judges on the Court of Appeals, members of the Workers' Compensation Board, when you're reading the transcript of this hearing? This does away with what you're saying. Now, it doesn't come much more direct than that. It doesn't come much clearer, and you won't be surprised to learn that in the Oregon Supreme Court's opinion in Safe versus Drews, the court quotes that and says it's pretty clear what the legislature intended. There's wording here that enables us to effectuate that intent, and thank you very much for the information. And so the clarity with which you state your intentions can be really helpful. Whether it's on the floor or in the committee hearings, either way, if you can be clear and direct about it, we're gonna do whatever we can to give it the weight that you intend.
Can I mention something here, Jack, about, again, a directive that you all have given us in the latest amendments to 174? and that is that you've told the courts, as you sometimes do, you've given us some pretty broad discretion in looking at legislative history. You've said to us that we can give it the weight that we deem appropriate. And again, you talk about something that's in the eyes of the beholder. So we want to be very careful to have principled reasons for how we give less or more weight to particular kinds of legislative history. Jack, after the statute was enacted, wrote a case called State versus Kelly. I know you remember it well because that case you actually talked about all of these things. And you talked about the value of a statement from an individual legislator or a non-legislator, if that's all you have. And we've got cases that say sometimes that's not entitled to very much weight, but the truth is, as Jack explained, it sure depends on the context. So in the case of an individual legislator, if you're the carrier of a bill, if you're the author, if you're the sponsor of the bill, or in some other leadership position, the fact that there's only one of you is going to mean a lot less than it would if you're not in one of those positions. And so that sort of common sense approach really matters, doesn't it?
That's absolutely right.
And there are some other rules that I know that that apply here as well we should probably talk about.
I just want to make sure there are no other questions before we roll along here.
Yes, Representative
Garrett. I just wanted to thank you and your colleagues because it means that with 7 justices on the Supreme Court and 10 on the Court of Appeals, it means there are at least 17 Oregonians who are willing to believe that we do not intend absurd results.
You're welcome. As Dave said, after we look at the text in its context, look at the legislative history, and before we leave legislative history, just one more time for emphasis, we use legislative history to clarify what the statute means. If the legislative history, you look at a statute and the language of the statute reasonably can mean A or B, and if the legislative history shows that you meant X, that's what courts call a mistake. And there isn't anything we can do to help you out there. If there isn't wording in there, the legislative history won't matter. In State versus Gaines, the Oregon Supreme Court emphasized this point with respect to the statute that Dave referred to, the amendments to ORS 174.020, that say we can look at legislative history in time. It's an aid, but we have to give it such weight as we deem it appropriate. And the Supreme Court said, in assessing that weight, everybody needs to keep in mind we still have to work with the words that are given us. And if the legislative history contradicts what the words say, the words will always win. So we have to remember that if you want to really fix something, fix the language of the statute, the courts, and I think this is the way we all want it. We don't want the courts changing the words of statutes because we have an idea of what you really meant, but you didn't say it.
Well, legislative history, Jack, is really, I think, very helpful to me and to members of our court, is where you've got a really broad term, and the meaning of the statute could be very broad, depending on what you have in mind, and where there's good legislative history that defines that scope, that can matter. We talk about hierarchy to anticipate another of your questions, and I think there's a common sense piece to this if you think about it. The more of you who heard what was said, the more likely it is that we'll give weight to it, especially if when all those people heard it, there wasn't any dissent voiced and a vote was taken immediately thereafter. So when you're talking about 4 votes on dash threes, for example, that sort of thing, anything that's said in front of, or a 4 vote, anything that's said in a 4 vote would be entitled to significant weight if there was no dissent from it. Committees is also very important. What you say in a committee, and especially if it passes without dissent from your colleagues in the committees, is going to be very, very helpful to us. There are some things that you never know. One thing our court is struggling with right now is the importance of a staff summary in committee. And we think that can have some weight. But it also depends on who read it and when they read it in relation to a vote. So if I were, we can't give you black and white rules here because there's play in the joints under the delegation you gave us. It's as appropriate. It depends on the context. But at least in my view, and I want to get your reaction, the more people who heard it without dissent and the closer thereafter that a vote, final vote was taken, the stronger the evidence is.
That's absolutely right. We're really trying to reconstruct what it is you're trying to accomplish in enacting the legislation. And so, for example, I remember a case in which one of the parties cited some legislative history from a public hearing. And we went back and listened to it and looked at the minutes, and it turns out there were only two members of the committee that were in the room at the time this particular statement was made. That's not going to be given as much weight as, for example, when what Dave said, there is a debate on the floor of the House. When everybody is there, and presumably if somebody objects to the carrier's representation of what the bill accomplishes, somebody would say so. And in the absence of somebody saying so, we say, well, gee, the carrier would be the one to trust about what was intended here in the absence of an objection from somebody else on the floor, that we're going to give that a lot of weight.
As I remember, too, there's a good example of this in the Blakely Fix legislation that you all did when the U.S. Supreme Court decided that folks were entitled to jury trials and sentencing in criminal cases. And a work group got together that consisted of lawyers, legislators, and a broad array and worked on some legislation that would solve some of the problems created by that U.S. Supreme Court decision. And there was an incredible amount of good legislative history created in that, including one of the debates was what kind of notice the defendant was entitled to if the state was going to seek an enhancement on a sentence so that the defendant could prepare for trial. And there was an argument about that. And some great legislative history was made even on the floor by Senator Burdick. And so that got quoted in our opinion, and we were absolutely confident after looking at the legislative history that that broad language of the statute allowed the state to do what it had done in that case.
Yeah. So, give you an example of how we use legislative history. We had a case several years ago involving a statute that makes it a crime to alter a motor vehicle license plate. What does alter mean? Well, the legislature defined it. And it said any frame or plate holder, you know, those I'd rather be skiing or I'd rather be shopping at Nordstrom's or whatever the things that go on those plates. Any frame or plate holder that obscures the numbers, letters, or registration stickers on the license plate. Well, what happened was the defendant in this particular case got one of those frames, and part of the frame went down and obscured the word Oregon, and was charged with violating the statute. Well, if you read the statute literally, Oregon is letters, and the license plate frame obscured the letters, and so technically, and the prosecutor certainly thought this was the case, that violated the statute. It could mean, on the other hand, that what the legislature really was talking about was the ability of the police to read, you know, those three letters and three big numbers that identify the registered owner of the vehicle, right? Well, which one is it? Looking at the surface of the statute, you can fairly say it could go either way. We went to the legislative history, and in that case, it was very clear that what the legislature was actually concerned about was the ability of law enforcement officials to identify the vehicle, not, you know, the fact that it obscured one of the letters in the state's name. And so we said, I suppose we could have also done this on an absurd results canon, but as Dave says, we don't like to do that because that gets us into more difficult waters. Who are we to say what's absurd or not? The legislative history made it very clear what it was you were about. That's how we routinely will go to the legislative history to help us resolve the ambiguity in the text. Other questions?
Mr. Chair, I'm concerned that a couple of Fish and Wildlife cops wouldn't understand that.
Wouldn't understand it, sir.
That's why he chases the taillights. It doesn't have to do investigations.
Stop.
And I would assume, too, that the person with the obscured word Oregon did something to make some officer pretty mad about something else. But I would have to guess on that.
What division he was working for.
Well, in a nutshell, in a nutshell, we regard on the courts the legislature as the principal policymaker. Our job is to give effect to those policies. In giving effect to those policies, we're constrained by a number of rules that we've talked about today. The policy choices have to be expressed in the words of the statute. We don't have the authority to change those words. In interpreting the words, we usually will give effect to whatever definitions that you supply. In the absence of those definitions, we'll assume that you use the words in the ordinary meaning. We'll look it up in the dictionary if we have to. Dictionaries, by the way, don't usually tell you what words mean. They tell you what words can mean. There are, you know, a bunch of different definitions. And what we will do is we'll then go back and look at how the word is used in the statute, in context, so that we can use the word in the way that we think you've intended it to. We'll consult legislative history with a mind, again, to effectuating your intentions. If and only if all that proves fruitless, will we then resort to a group of judicially crafted canons of construction to kind of break the tie? And even then, those canons, those rules, are developed by the courts with a view to deferring to the policy judgments of the legislature and giving the legislature every possible benefit of the doubt.
One of the things that we always ask ourselves, I would say that well over 90% of the statutory construction problems that we have are resolved by text and context, and that reinforces Justice Landau's point that you all do a very, very good job in making your intention known. In another few percent, the legislative history is conclusive. But one of the things that I always ask myself, when Jack and I were on the same court together for 12 years, the overarching question we'd have in some of these areas where it's really hard to tell which direction to go is what comports with common sense. And there isn't a statute that says that, but it's implied in everything you've given us in terms of looking at ordinary meanings, unless it's clear that you don't intend the ordinary meaning, thinking about things in the way that the system ought to work, looking at the purpose of an act. There are often, you've done a good job at the beginning of a chapter setting out the purpose of an act so that even if in the first section of that chapter, so that even if it's not clear what the scope of a particular statute is, if we go back and look at the purpose, that can clarify things. We get increasingly more uncomfortable that we're straying across a line if the rules that we're applying don't comport with common sense. And I tell you, nothing has driven us crazier than a situation where, and I guess we're kind of back to that black versus white situation, where we know that in a rare case, we've got to construe a statute a certain way because of the words, and we know that's not what you meant. And it just makes us sick. I've had a chance in the past to talk to Co-Chair Krieger about this very issue. We've had some good conversations about it, not to be able to just fix it ourselves. But if we do that, we're violating the separation of powers. And there isn't anything more important than following the Constitution and the words of the statute you've given us. And so I do want to mention the Chief, I thought, Chief Justice DeMunis, just did a great job recently in a case called Barger. And I don't know if you wanted to chat about that a little bit, but it's a child pornography statute case. And the opinion just came out about 3 weeks ago. And the Supreme Court went through, in a companion case, their standard statutory construction analysis. Jack didn't vote on that case. I think he had, right? Yeah, you just came on the court a week or so later. But the Chief took the trouble to write a concurrence. And in that concurrence, he looked at how other states had addressed this problem and pointed out, even though in past years some judges might not have thought that was their job, how the legislature could draft a statute that might better accomplish a certain intention. You can argue that's not the job of the judiciary. You can argue that our job is simply to call balls and strikes and then go home with our lunch bucket. But I commend the Chief for not doing that. I commend the Chief for having that kind of conversation. One of the things that we can do, and our hands are out for this, to extend to you to shake hands over this, is if you ever want the help of the Oregon Judicial Department in talking about statutory language as you're crafting things in terms of the effect on the courts, I know the Chief Justice would love to hear from you about that and to have these conversations that we're having today occur before the fact. And we've had the privilege, and I'm looking at Representative Schaffler and Krieger right now, of working with many of you on interbranch work groups designed to get at exactly that. We've got a trial-level work group going on in juvenile dependency right now that has members of all the branches, and we're taking a pretty ambitious approach, not for this session, but for an ongoing basis, to look at trying to figure out a way to make the system of juvenile dependency in this state fully integrated at a substantive level among all the operations of the three branches, and then looking at it budget-wise that way too, so that we're funding and we're structuring a coherent system. Those conversations are perfectly appropriate. I think the day and age of judges just sort of sitting in ivory towers is long gone. We can't afford that. We have to work together before the fact to avoid doing this calling of balls and strikes later that I think only breeds mistrust. And we don't want that. So, Jack, I didn't want to just steal your thunder.
Excuse me, do you have a Representative Hicks a question?
Yeah, I just want to chime in. For instance, the Barger decision and sort of the significance of the legislature's very careful approach to the language itself. You know, the chief was helpful in his concurrence, but you know the consequences of that. I mean, from what this body originated and the court interpreted, are now that everybody who's been convicted under that statute gets to appeal. Every child pornographer who's been convicted in the past since that statute was written now is going to appeal. And I don't know how those appeals are going to go. So, I mean, this stuff is serious. I mean, these are people we don't want back out on the street. And I know the court did take that very, in a weighty manner. But so I just wanted to chime in. This stuff, it's not just license plate frames. So, and I'll finish the point there.
If I could, Chairs and Representative Hicks, as a person who practiced law for 16 years and was also a trial judge in Lane County for 6 years, I know exactly what you're talking about. And I can't speak for, you know, how the Supreme Court made its decision in that case. Our court obviously wrote on the cases as well. My point in bringing it up was really sort of the solution-oriented approach, but you can be sure of this, that every time, particularly we look at these constitutional law issues that involve, for example, citizen police encounters, where a police officer, a citizen, have to make snap judgments on the street about what is or is not appropriate to do by way of stops and all of that sort of thing, we've got to apply common sense. Always within the rule of law, but we've got to be thinking about the effects of what we say and do through that light of common sense. That's absolutely critical. I couldn't agree with you more.
Thank you.
So I know that
Mr. Cater is waving his hand in the back of the room.
I just want to let you know that that afternoon, after the opinion, there was a request on the Legislative Council's office to change the statute.
Yeah.
You very graciously scheduled us for 2 hours, and we're an hour and a quarter into this. We don't want to unnecessarily take your time, but as we said at the outset, we're here for any discussion you'd like to have. I would just say this one final thing, too, is the chief is really very pleased that you wanted to have this session today, and his hand is extended at all times in cooperation. We do want to make it clear that the judicial branch does speak with one voice through the Chief Justice, and we're very grateful for his support. And as I said, any time you want to have conversations like this, he would love to continue that.
Thank you. And Representative Schaffer.
Yeah, thank you. In 2005, Representative Krieger, then he was chair of the Judiciary Committee then, without consulting me, appointed me to the Termination of Parental Rights Sensitive Review Committee, and then I added, went on to the continued in the juvenile dependency work group, and it's really helped me a lot understand your branch of government. But you know, you talk about absurd, what's absurd or not, common sense, and I don't, you don't have to comment on this. But whenever whenever, and this is usually mostly to the federal court. I really don't see this at the state, our state level very often. But if the federal court or the Supreme Court, if I agree with their determination or interpretation, well, they're all geniuses. But if I disagree with them, they're just a bunch of judicial activists. So I don't know. You probably get a lot of that. I don't know. I don't read about that in the state level very often.
I do. If we're in the kind of a general question period, I've got kind of a smaller point and then to segue to a larger point, then a question, which is this, going way back to the beginning of the discussion, you know, about the Constitution, I've actually got a bill somewhere in the pipeline to change the name of the Judicial Department and the Legislative Department to Judicial Branch and Legislative Branch. I mean, there's a couple reasons, certainly the separation of powers, and also I think it's very easy to confuse the Judicial Department with the Department of Justice, which are two significantly different entities, and so I won't ask for the court's opinion on that just point, but I do want to ask for this. There's another bill floating around out there. Might have been Representative Smith or someone. I saw it on the green sheet proposing a constitutional convention for 2015. And so that's the question. I mean, I'm not asking you to go on the record or anything, but I mean, what are your thoughts? Is it worth it or what? I don't know if it's coming to this committee, but
is that chair? I don't know if it's a good idea to get these new attorneys on here or not.
Co-chairs, Representative Hicks, not going to take the bait. but I will say there is a recent, as in the last year or so, when the Oregon State Bar Bulletin, it's the monthly magazine of the bar, actually published a really interesting debate between two lawyers, Jim Westwood on the one hand, Charlie Hinkle on the other, one of them arguing in favor of a constitutional convention, and here's why we need it, and the other one arguing in opposition and saying, it ain't broke, don't fix it. And I commend that to you if you're really interested.
Yeah, I've read that. I remember when that came out.
Could we take at least this much bait, Jack? Because... You'll have a pretty good answer for Representative Hicks to this sub-question, I think, and that is, have we seen constitutional conventions and revision processes in other states that have gone all the way through to fruition in the last decade or so?
Co-chairs, Representative Hicks, that's actually very interesting. Oregon is one of a very few states still living off of its original constitution. Most states have completely revised their constitutions twice, three times, four, or more times. And in the last 50 years, there have been a number of states that have either held constitutional conventions or the legislature itself has been involved in resolving and sending to the people an entirely new constitution. Part of the reason that Oregon and Western states have tended not to have constitutional conventions is because of the initiative and referendum power and the relative ease with which it is possible to amend the constitution. We have lots and lots of amendments to our Constitution. So you could argue about whether we actually do have the original Constitution, but that probably explains part of it.
On the other hand, Jack, isn't that, at least in terms of the debate that he's referring to, Representative Hicks, part of the push-pull? And some people argue that because of all of the amendments that have occurred, there's a patchwork quilt that requires an overarching synthesization, if you will. Others say leave it alone because you've got this ability to come in and amend. This is, I think, part of the substantive debate.
I mean, part of the arguments are that because of the initiative process, Oregon's Constitution is becoming cluttered with a lot of stuff that really doesn't belong in the Constitution, like, you know, we all have a constitutional right to get liquor by the glass. It's actually there in the Oregon Constitution.
And we don't have nobility.
And we don't have titles of nobility. On the other hand, the arguments are the Constitution is a reflection of the will of the people as set out in the enactment and ratification processes of the Constitution, and for whether we individually think it's a good idea or bad, this is the Constitution the people want. Those are the arguments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you both honorable judges for your presentation. I've heard this before. I have a question and a comment about your presentation. In looking for intent, do you ever personally interview the legislator or someone on that committee, or is it all used text? Or hearing data?
Do you want to go ahead with that one,
Chair? Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnant, that's actually a really good question. The rule of law in this state and in every other jurisdiction I'm aware of is that when the court tries to figure out what the intentions of the legislature are, our focus is on the legislature that enacted the bill into law, that particular point in time. And as a result of that, the only evidence that the court will look at is evidence that was generated during that legislative session. The legislative history consists of whatever gets generated during the life of that bill from the day the legislature starts to sine die, nothing afterwards. And the general rule is that affidavits of legislators after the fact are simply not admissible evidence, if you will, of legislative intent. The courts just can't look at it. But if you think about it, that makes sense, because otherwise we could have competing parties collecting affidavits from different groups of you 5, 6, 7, 10, 20 years later, and then we would have to be in the position of trying to sort all that out. The courts instead limit themselves to the record that was generated at the time, the idea being that's the most reliable evidence of what the legislature intended.
And there's another common sense problem here, isn't there, Jack? And that is that a lot of times some of that intent may have been unexpressed, and if it had been expressed, others might have disagreed with it. And so that's why, for us, it's kind of an objective test. And we apply, if you think about it, the same principles in deciding contract disputes. If you and I, Representative Wisnant, enter into a contract, and I think that the subject matter is X and you think it's Y, the law says that our subjective intentions aren't really relevant to the discussion unless they were expressed in our mutual agreement or in the words we chose. And so the idea of how we treat our civil disputes is very similar to how we look at what the legislature did. And I think one of the great tragedies, though, and this points out that discussion that we've been having, is what if you really meant to say something and nobody said it on the record? And that's just, this stuff has to be cabined in order to be effective under the rule of law. But what really hurts us all is when, just wish we would have said something and we didn't get around to it.
Thank you. My comment is not towards the courts, but I had a very unpleasant experience with the Department of Justice and the state agency that didn't take the trouble to ask me, and it was my bill. My name was the only bill, name on the bill, and they didn't have a personal interview with me. My other comment, Mr. Chairs, is that I hope Ramona's listening, and I think this is, I've heard this testimony or talk about intent, legislative intent, a couple of times. I've had the pleasure and honor of serving on this committee for 4 sessions, and I think that all new members in their orientation, if your branch of government could find someone of your skill and talent to come in and talk to all new members, I think, because it's not just this committee that's going to have be concerned with intent, but you might want to see if we could set that up with a clerk for all new members of the body to have a brief discussion about intent of legislation.
Chairs and Representative Wisnant, we stand ready. We do not invite ourselves, however. I mean, we appear by invitation. We do not insinuate, but we do stand ready. That offer stands from the chief.
Thank you very much. Mr.
Chair, very briefly, on that, on the intent idea, though, that someone, I mean, we're all from different walks of life here. We're not all lawyers like Representative Garrett and our other colleagues here, but you may think a bill is going to be doing something, and you may say it in a microphone, this bill intends to do this, and you know what? That language don't say that. So you can say it till you're blue in the face. If the words don't say it, that ain't what's going to happen. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schroffer, that is absolutely correct.
Right.
Okay. Anything further? Representative Tomei?
Thank you so much. I feel like I've had a day of law school, so this has been fascinating. Thank you so much. Not at all painful. Maybe wish I'd become a lawyer instead of a social worker. But In any case, could you talk some about Oregon's constitution being more liberal in terms of public speech, not public speech, what is the word?
Freedom of speech.
Freedom of speech. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative May, that's actually a whole subject all by itself. In a nutshell, every state has its own constitution, separate and apart from the federal constitution, because of, and every state constitution has its own Bill of Rights. Every state's Bill of Rights is more or less patterned after the original Bill of Rights, although it's somewhat ironically, the original Bill of Rights was actually based on state constitutions that existed at the time. Under the Supremacy Clause of the Federal Constitution, however we interpret our state constitutions, the rights that are conferred or that are protected by the state constitutions cannot be any less protective of individual rights than the federal constitution, right? We can't go below that. But that doesn't mean that the state constitution has to mean the same thing that the federal constitution does. And in fact, the state constitutions sometimes use wording that's very, very different and on its face more protective of rights than the federal constitution. The First Amendment, for example, says that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of the press and freedom of speech. In Oregon's constitution, as I mentioned before, Article 1, Section 8 says no law shall be passed restraining the free expression of opinion or the right to speak, write, or print freely on any subject whatever. And so what the Oregon courts are confronted with is trying to figure out what did the framers of the Oregon Constitution intend that guarantee to mean. We're not constrained to make it mean the same thing as the First Amendment, as long as it's at least as protective as the First Amendment. And so what the Oregon Supreme Court did is it examined the text and the history of Oregon's Free Expression Clause and concluded, we can disagree or agree about it, but the court concluded that the language, which is very, very broad, and the record of what the framers intended at the time results in the court being more protective of expression rights than the rights that are protected under free speech under the First Amendment. The key example is under the First Amendment in Roth versus the United States, obscenity is simply not considered speech within the meaning of the First Amendment. It's not protected. But in State versus Henry, a case back in the 1980s, the Oregon Supreme Court said, well, contrary to the First Amendment, the framers of the Oregon Constitution wanted to be more protective of individual rights of free expression. And so obscene publications are constitutionally protected under the Oregon Constitution.
Jack, can I add one supplement to that, too? Because what we think of, Mr. Chairs and Representative Tomei, is the federal constitution provides a constitutional floor for rights. We don't lightly assume that comparable language, though, in the Oregon Constitution is intended to create a different set of rights. So, for example, there are some provisions of the Oregon Constitution where the Oregon Supreme Court has said it was the intention of the framers to provide a comparable right to that provided under the U.S. Constitution. And so there are certain provisions, particularly in the criminal law, where the Supreme Court has said it will generally follow U.S. Supreme Court jurisprudence in construing the Oregon provision. And so this problem arises primarily where the language isn't the same and the Oregon language seems broader. And it does get back into that business we talked about at the very beginning of the awkwardness of trying to determine intent that's 152 years old now, in many cases, through the lens of a modern world that is so different from what our parents, grandparents, great-grandparents might have envisioned. And the courts are increasingly less comfortable where that vagueness exists because we do not want to be an unelected legislature. That is not our role. But there are times where you feel like you don't have as much of an anchor as we should have in order to be consistent in our jurisprudence.
I remember back in the 70s, we didn't have Fox News, so we didn't have the term judicial activist quite so frequently, but I remember a lot of those decisions where they seemed to be a major shift was when Justice Lindy was making some of those decisions. And as far as explaining the free speech and everything, I wish you could have been at the town hall to calm down the howling mob who didn't understand how a naked dancer was part of free speech in Oregon, but I couldn't explain it either, but they were asking.
Well, and a minute to demonstrate.
Well, thank you very much for your taking your valuable time to come here, and it is, as some of the newer members really find this very important and informative, and I thank you again, all of us do, for your taking your time to come meet with us and share with us. And I will speak to Ramona about the clerk about having some kind of a program for new members, because not just judiciary, of course, everybody's making these policy laws. So,
especially the chairs, I would think that would be really important.
Is there anything further? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Is there anything more to come before the committee? Committee adjourned.